This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another, then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader says events marking the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani proved that his martyrdom only promoted his campaign. Anti-vaxxers turn out in cities across France to voice their anger at the government's planned restrictions. And a bleak milestone for one of the European countries worst affected by COVID. The UK says more than 150,000 people have died after catching the coronavirus.
Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the United States' assassination of Lieutenant General Soleimani has only further strengthened the movement that the anti-terror commander set in motion. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Washington was under the illusion that by assassinating General Soleimani, they could stop his struggle. However, the U.S. later found out that it had not but made a miscalculation, as the assassination of the top commander only further promoted his anti-terror campaign. Also in his comments, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that Washington's profound animosity toward the Islamic Republic emanates from the religious nature of Iran's establishment. According to the leader, tyrants have always been opposed to movements and establishments with a religious foundation. The leader delivered a speech on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Iran against the dictatorial rule of the then Pahlavi monarch. From the city of Qom, I'm now bringing in Sam Mehtetrabi, director of the Risaleh Strategic Studies Institute. Good to have you with us, Sam. So let's hear your comments on the points that the leader of the Islamic Revolution just made.
Yeah, I think he's said something which is an important point that we have to remember, which is that this issue of the enemies of Iran really not understanding what Iran is a theme that keeps repeating itself. It's not only about history and them not understanding Iran at the time of the revolution. We see that it still happens till today. We saw it after the election, where they tried to have a coup d'etat in Iran after the contested elections there was. And we also saw it recently after the assassination of Khatib Qasem, General Soleimani. And this is a reality. Every couple of years, every 2-3 years, we see these movements about, you know, Iran is changing, Iran is secular, Iran is not as religious as it used to be, all these things. Of course, one of the things that is never mentioned is, of course, that we have, you know, nearly three times as much population as we had 40 years ago. So it might appear to some that there are more religious people, but the issue is, less religious people, but the issue is that if you look at the sum of the society, if you look at the percentage in terms of the whole society, and this is something also that the Supreme Leader pointed out, he said, unfortunately, we see these biased samples and these biased opinion polls that are conducted, they don't represent the totality of Iranian society. If you want to understand the totality of Iranian society, you have to look at these events, these big events, such as the ones that I mentioned, and then you will see what the reality of the Iranian society is. And of course, that's the basis of having a revolution and having a system of governance that's based on the people, which is, you know, the greatest threat to the enemies of Iran, whether it's the Americans or whether it's their local vassal protectorates, because they, of course, do not have systems of governance that are based on the will of the people. They are based on families or military dictators or some very small elite being supported by the Americans or in the past by the British and the French, and they rule without any sort of thought about what their populations want or need. And this is the significance of what happened in Iran 43 years ago. The people, the religious Islamic Muslim people of Iran, based on their belief, took their destiny into their own hands with the leadership of Imam Khomeini. And this is a very organic and very natural result of what the society is. And to this day, this is the reason why there is so much animosity, because they do not want this to be repeated in this very important strategic area of the world, West Asia, and in the heart of the Islamic Ummah, which is West Asia. So this is the root of it all.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Sam Mahdi Torabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute in the city of Qom. Tehran has updated the list of American individuals blacklisted for involvement in the assassination of Iran's top General Soleimani and his companions. Iran's foreign ministry announced it has added 51 U.S. officials to the list. Washington acted in glorification of terrorism and violation of the fundamental human rights by conducting, quote, the callous terrorist act. The foreign ministry promised that the heinous terrorist act will not diminish the resolute determination of Iran in following the path of General Soleimani in fighting terror. On January 3, 2020, the U.S. assassinated Soleimani and his companions, including Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike near Baghdad Airport. The political commentator Deputy Avobian says that the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani was a gross violation of international law.
This was a unilateral, unprovoked attack that constituted a war crime and a gross violation of the United Nations Charter. And this isn't just me and other guests on TV saying this. This is from Agnes Callamard, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, who in her report was clear about the sheer illegality of this heinous attack. And so, therefore, it's clear justice must be served. And certainly, it was important to put the upper crust of the U.S. leadership that was responsible for this heinous attack on notice that justice is going to be served. That would be individuals such as Donald Trump and Bolton and Pompeo. But as we know, the U.S. deep state is quite large, and there are many individuals, as this list of 51 now expanded attests to, who are directly responsible for either the planning of the attack, the organization of the attack, the financing of the attack, and ultimately carrying out the attack. So this list of 51 is a reflection of the, list of those who will need to be called to court or to face justice in some form for the assassination of General Soleimani, Mohandas, and their colleagues.
The Iranian foreign minister says that reaching a good agreement is possible in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna in case the Western side shows necessary goodwill and determination. Hossein Amir Abdullahian noted that Iran has the necessary determination to achieve an agreement through goodwill. He made a comment during a phone call with his Indian counterpart. Meantime, Iran's top negotiator in the talks says the participants in the negotiations are heading forward and making progress. Ali Bagherikenyan says differences among the parties are narrowing, and this as the other sides have also voiced optimism about the pace of the negotiations. A short time ago, we're joined by our Vienna correspondent, and Huma Lezgi provided us with some details about Iran P4 plus one talks in Vienna.
We just had a tweet from the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, the main source of the news, mostly from these talks on Twitter. And he said that at the end of today, there's been another, in his words, traditional meeting between the 4+1, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA minus Iran and the U.S. delegation, during which, in the words of Mr. Olyanov, the difficult issue of guarantees of a non-repetition of recent problems, he says, was discussed, and he said that the Russian delegation had presented a number of suggestions in this regard. We know, of course, that the issue of guarantees and verification when it comes to the U.S. sanctions removal is of key importance for the Iranian delegation led by Mr. Bagherikiani. Now, going back to the two important issues of guarantees and verification, what Iran has asked for since the beginning of these negotiations, basically, to restore the JCPOA, has been that it wants enough guarantees to be able to get an assurance that the U.S. Will not withdraw from the JCPOA again without Iran being able to benefit from the deal effectively. So it says that it will only go back to its commitments after the verified and effective removal of U.S. sanctions. It wants guarantees that the U.S. will not impose any additional sanctions once the deal is restored that would violate the JCPOA or that would impede its implementation.
The Syrian army has intercepted a U.S. military convoy in the Hasaka countryside, the country's northeastern corner, forcing them to retreat. According to Syrian media, the convoy of four armored vehicles was driven out of a village north of the town of Tal Tamer. The U.S. military has stationed troops and equipment in the eastern and northeastern parts of Syria. The Pentagon claims that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says that the unlawful deployment violates Syria's sovereignty and is meant to plunder its resources. Now, in the hours ahead, the United States and Russia will start a comprehensive round of talks on points of friction, with a dispute over Ukraine likely topping the agenda. The much-anticipated discussions will be held in Geneva. Senior diplomats Wendy Sherman and Sergei Ryabkov will be heading the U.S. and Russian delegations. The talks are being held at the request of Kremlin that's seeking a wide-ranging new security agreement with the White House. Washington says many of Moscow's proposals are simply non-starters. Russia is expected to initiate separate talks with NATO next week. Moscow wants the Western alliance to stop its eastward expansion. Arms control, human rights in various armed conflicts around the globe are other topics that will likely be at the heart of discussions. The talks will be held on Sunday and Monday, followed by a Russia-NATO meeting on Wednesday. The anti-COVID restriction protests once again hit Europe amid a fresh surge in the number of infections there. In France, some 100,000 people turned out in Paris and other cities to voice their anger. They're infuriated over government's plans to further restrict the unvaccinated. A planned law requires proof of vaccination for everyone entering a restaurant, boarding a train, or attending an event. Similar events were held in Italy and Germany. Some countries in Europe have been reporting record number of cases, mostly blamed on the new Omicron variant. France has reported over France has reported over 300,000 cases for a third time in a week. Britain, Italy, and Russia have also witnessed record number of cases.
Again, we use the word a lot, but there's a great deal of concern here in the European Union. And what the experts are saying is that they anticipate, just like we saw in the middle of January 2021, that in about a week's time, we're going to see a surge. We're going to see the results of large gatherings, people coming together during the holiday period. We saw it 12 months ago, and that's what they're predicting now in 7 days' time. So, you know, the true number of cases, actually, I mean, you talk about in Italy almost 200,000 new cases in a 24-hour period, and more than 150,000 in Spain. But the true number of cases, of course, is expected to be much, much higher, because different countries in the EU, the 27 countries, they have different capacities in terms of testing. So in terms of people having symptoms and trying to get a PCR test, in some countries it's relatively easy, in some countries it's very difficult. And also the availability of rapid antigen tests are also, that varies greatly across the EU as well, depending on the situation of the pandemic and how it's affecting the population. So, you know, the problem is, of course, Omicron is less deadly, but when you have, you know, the population here, 430 million people, you have almost 150 million adults who have not been vaccinated. But even, you know, with Omicron being less deadly, the more and more people it affects, even a small percentage of a huge number of people means that invariably that hospitals are going to be put under pressure.
Now, Iran has reported 700 new coronavirus infections. That's the lowest number of daily cases in almost 2 years. Some 6 million people have contracted the virus. 24 people died of COVID in the past day, bringing the overall death toll to around 131,000. Iran set another record low on Friday, recording only 19 fatalities, the lowest daily toll also in 2 years. COVID-related figures have been declining in Iran thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. 122 million jabs have been administered. That includes more than 60 million people who have received their first dose. 52 million have also received a second dose, while nearly 10 million people have received a booster shot. The Omicron variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, including in Mexico. The country is reporting more than 30,000 daily COVID infections, the highest since the beginning of the pandemic. Also, the death toll has surpassed the 300,000. Mexico is the world's fifth worst-hit country. Experts believe that the figures are even much higher than the authorities announce. President López Obrador has acknowledged that a new tide is coming, but ruled out any nationwide restrictions. Still, some states have closed schools again to curb the spread. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
It's often overlooked that sending weapons to rogue nations like Saudi Arabia and the UAE undermines U.S. security interests, says William Harting, writer, in an article published under the heading, Arms Sales to Repressive Regimes Are More Than Just a Human Rights Issue. Stay tuned for more. Critics of U.S. arms sales policy often oppose questionable deals based on their impacts on human rights and civilian harm, and rightly so. The devastation and repression fueled by U.S. transfers to regimes like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and the Philippines should be opposed based on the human consequences, not to mention the impact on the United States' reputation in the world. But it is less often noted that sales to these same governments undermine U.S. national security writ large. For example, as noted in a July 2020 Quincy Institute report on U.S. interests in the West Asia region, emphasis added, The U.S. military's large footprint in the region, combined with voluminous U.S. arms sales and support for repressive regimes, drives instability and exacerbates grievances and conditions that threaten the United States. Indeed, the well over $100 billion in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE over the past decade has enabled and emboldened them to wage a devastating war in Yemen that has resulted in the death of over a quarter million people and put millions at risk of famine, even as it has fueled animus towards the United States and served as a recruiting tool for extremist groups. As Senator Chris Murphy has noted, there is a U.S. imprint on every civilian death inside Yemen. This is no way to win fields and friends or positively influence nations in the region. The UAE's regional role also undermines long-term U.S. interests. By violating a UN embargo on the parties to the war in Libya and launching drone strikes there, it has undermined efforts to settle the conflict, to the detriment of peace and stability in North Africa. But the damage to U.S. security inflicted by UAE doesn't stop there. As John Hoffman, a PhD candidate at George Mason University, has noted, the UAE's rogue behavior has been detrimental to U.S. interest, not only within the West Asia region, but at home as well. From supporting the coup that brought the Sisi regime to power in Egypt to backing other regimes in the world to supporting the military suppression of democracy movement in Sudan to surveilling U.S. citizens and attempting to interfere in the U.S. political process, the UAE has consistently taken actions that threaten democracy at home and abroad and make the West Asia North Africa region more dangerous, unstable, and conflict-ridden. If these aren't actions of an ally who needs enemies, and why your billions of dollars of weapons into supporting such a regime, a move that only enables its reckless behavior and serves as an endorsement of its conduct? A recognition of the security consequences of runaway arms sales to repressive regimes, coupled with attention to human rights and civilian harm, could reverse the long-standing tendency to throw human rights overboard in arms sales decision-making. In its year-end overview of U.S. arms sales in 2021, the State Department asserted that when it comes to arms sales, the United States follows a holistic approach, which weighs political, military, economic, non-proliferation, technology, security, end use, and human rights factors to determine the appropriate provision of military equipment. But U.S. offers of combat aircraft, armed drones, missiles, and bombs to repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and the Philippines make it clear that human rights are at the bottom of the list when it comes to deciding which nations to arm. A clearer understanding of how these sales also undercut broader U.S. interests might change that calculus. The role of arms sales to repressive regimes in harming U.S. security should be a central concern of the Biden administration's forthcoming Conventional Arms Transfer Directive. The document, which is meant to guide U.S. arms transfer decision-making, needs to underscore the multiple downsides of arming autocratic and aggressive governments rather than treating human rights as a separate category with no additional consequences beyond the urgent but too often overlooked need to stop enabling massive harm to civilians. If the U.S. administration does so and follows through on its pronouncements, it can help make the world a safer place, serving U.S. security interests in the process.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique.
The English High Court has decided that Julian Assange can be extradited to the United States. The High Court overturned a lower court's decision from January, which blocked the extradition of the Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder. Assange faces up to 175 years in U.S. prison for publishing diplomatic cables and classified documents, which show war crimes committed by the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. The High Court said that it trusts the assurances provided by the U.S. not to put Assange in oppressive prison conditions and to let him serve a potential sentence in Australia. A few weeks ago on this program, we debunked these assurances. I published classified documents from the case of David Mendoza, who was also extradited to the United States and given almost identical assurances that he could serve his sentence back home. These documents unquestionably prove how the United States violated its diplomatic assurances. In its ruling, the High Court said that it examined Mendoza's case, among others, and found no wrongdoing on the part of the Americans and nothing to suggest that the United States had violated its diplomatic assurances in the past or that it would do the same with Assange. With all due respect, the High Court could not be more wrong. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Before I explain the High Court's judgment, here's a brief recap to remind you where we are exactly in the Assange case. In January 2021, District Judge Vanessa Barreza blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S. on health grounds. She found U.S. prisons to be too oppressive and that the conditions of Assange's confinement would lead him to commit suicide. A few months later, in October, the United States went to the English High Court and appealed against this decision on five grounds. Then, on the morning of December 10th, the High Court issued its judgment. I was there in remote attendance at the High Court, and I reported live as Lord Justice Timothy Holroyd read out the decision allowing the extradition of the WikiLeaks founder to go ahead. In its ruling, the High Court denied the U.S. appeal on three out of five grounds. These were grounds 1, 3, and 4. In essence, the High Court accepted that Assange suffered from a precarious mental condition. It accepted that the district judge applied the test correctly under Section 91 of the Extradition Act when she found his extradition to be oppressive. At the same time, the High Court did allow the U.S. appeal to go ahead on grounds 2 and 5. The High Court accepted the diplomatic assurances given by the United States and agreed that the district judge, quote, ought to have notified the USA of her provisional view to afford it the opportunity of offering assurances to the court. As we've highlighted before, these diplomatic assurances provided by the U.S. pose several problems. Just by reading them, you can immediately see that the United States has given itself a way out to avoid abiding by its promises. For example, the first assurance says, quote, the United States will not impose special administrative measures, SAMs, on Mr. Assange pre-trial or post-conviction. However, in the same sentence, it says the United States still reserves the right to impose SAMs if Assange were to, quote, commit any future act that met the test for the imposition of a SAM. So what does that mean exactly? What would meet the test for an imposition of a SAM? This is very ambiguous and unclear. The United States could frankly find any reason to say that Assange is threatening national security or some other excuse and then throw him in SAMs to spite him.
You're on your phone call, like I was with a family relative, my mom. And I say to my mom on that phone call from prison, you know, tell my buddy that he needs to go see my attorney. Well, that in itself, the prison monitoring system kicks it back to security, their high level of review. And that, just that simple comment, would put him in a facility, probably ADF.
The United States also has things like Communications Management Units, CMU, or Special Housing Units, SHU, where it can lock prisoners up in isolation. The United States could easily place Assange in either of those and then say, we didn't break any assurances, we only said we wouldn't put him in SAMs. Yes, but the whole reason Assange's extradition was blocked in the first place is because of the isolation, the solitary confinement, the prison conditions that would make him take his own life, not to mention the extradition itself. So whether you put him in a CMU or SHU or SAMS, it's all the same and could still lead him to take his own life. Now, the second assurance provided by the United States is that, quote, if Mr. Assange is convicted in the U.S., he will be eligible, following conviction, sentencing, and conclusion of any appeals, to apply for a prisoner transfer to Australia to serve his U.S. sentence. As the lead U.S. prosecutor James Lewis put it, Assange can now look forward to going to jail in his home country, Australia. Now here's the problem with this assurance. The United States cannot just snap its fingers and say, fine, you can go to Australia. Both the U.S. and Australia have to agree first. Now under Article 3 of the Convention on the Transfer of Sentenced Persons, it clearly says that, quote, a sentenced person may be transferred under this convention only on the following conditions. F. If the sentencing and administering states agree to the transfer. I can personally confirm that so far Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. And the High Court judges know this. They even say it in the judgment. They say that despite Australia giving no indication, this cannot be attributed as a fault or criticism of the United States. Now, if Assange is extradited, he will be tried at the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Virginia, commonly known as the Espionage Court, because it regularly uses the Espionage Act of 1917 against journalists and whistleblowers. Chelsea Manning, who gave classified documents to Assange, was tried here. The indictment against NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and Julian Assange were also unsealed here. Another person who was tried at this court under the Espionage Act is Jeffrey Sterling, who used to work for the CIA. In 2010, Sterling was accused of leaking classified information to a reporter about a CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear program called Operation Merlin. He was charged under the Espionage Act and threatened with hundreds of years in prison, drawing comparisons to Assange. In 2015, Sterling was sentenced to 3.5 years imprisonment. This whole debacle came several years after he had been fired from the CIA when he tried taking them to court over racist treatment that he had been subjected to while working at the agency. Given his background in U.S. intelligence and being a former CIA man himself, I asked Sterling how likely he thinks it is that the United States could go through back channels and tell Australia, another Five Eyes country, not to take its own citizen, Julian Assange, to serve any potential sentence down under. You being having a background in the intelligence community, again, this is just speculation, but how likely is it that the United States has gone through back channels and told Australia not to take Assange? Because we know very well under Article 3F of the Strasbourg Treaty, both countries need to agree to the prison transfer. It can't be just the U.S. saying yes and then he's magically taken to Australia. Australia needs to say yes too. How likely is it that the U.S. can go to back channels and just tell the Australians not to take him?
I think it's very likely, if not, if it hasn't happened already. With individuals, the main thing with, related to this, the main thing with Assange is that the U.S. has engaged in character assassination for years upon years against Assange, characterizing him essentially as a terrorist and a danger to the national interests of this country. With that as the backdrop, the U.S. can refuse to provide any information with regard to Assange to any other country, particularly Australia, if they want to hold him. The U.S. can hold him indefinitely at the U.S.'s leisure and in whatever facility they would like to hold him. I was in a low security facility. I technically wasn't under the special administrative SAMS program or monitoring my communications. But again, I was never told that I was. I think the question is open whether I was or not. I certainly got a lot of responses from individuals about letters that I would receive, questions about certain phone calls, things like that. I wasn't limited in who I could email, yet it just felt like I was being monitored. One example, and I think this set off many alarm bells for the prison, if not the Bureau of Prisons, my wife sent me some Farsi language books so I could at least just try to maintain my language ability. She did that. I had no idea. It was only months later when they provided me the books. And I said, well, what? And I asked, what was the holdup? And they were just, they said, well, we've never seen that language before. And I know what they were saying. It looks like Arabic, and am I a terrorist sort of thing? And again, that is related to how the Department of Justice characterized me, and throw in the national security aspect. And that is certainly what is going to be the case with Assange. He is going to be in the most secure facility that they can find. The Bureau of Prisons can act in whatever way it wants. However, it will take guidance from the intelligence community with regard to how Assange will be held.
Even if Australia gives prior consent and agrees to the transfer in advance, under the Prisoner Transfer Treaty, you can only request a transfer once your sentence has been finalized. That means if Assange is taken to the U.S. and he loses in court and they give him a lengthy sentence, which is practically guaranteed, what's the first thing Assange is going to do? He's going to appeal it. So he'll go first to the appellate court in that particular district, a process that can take around 4 years alone. Assange will eventually lose there as well, and then he'll ask to take his case to the Supreme Court. That could also take another 3 to 4 years, and that's if they even hear his case at all. Mendoza thinks that's highly unlikely.
I know what they're playing there, too. They're going to give him a long sentence, and then they're going to say, well, if you, because you can't get transferred until your sentence is finalized. So they're going to tell him, if you want to get transferred, you've got to accept the sentence. You can't appeal it to the Supreme Court. And that's a game that they're going to play. They're going to write him out for another 10 or 15 years until that gets decided in the Supreme Court, if it does get decided in the Supreme Court, because many times the Supreme Court won't take the case. It'll sit there and dock it for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And then they just say, send you back a note later and say, well, we've decided not to accept this case.
In Mendoza's case, Mendoza wasn't just given a diplomatic assurance that he could serve his sentence back home, like they're telling Assange. Mendoza even signed a contract with the United States and Spain that he would be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. A contract is a legally binding document, and the United States broke it anyway. So what chance does Assange or anyone else stand? Now, another assurance given by the Americans is that once Assange is in U.S. custody, he would be given medical treatment to help with any physical and psychological ailments. The U.S. says it will ensure that Mr. Assange will receive any such clinical and psychological treatment, quote, as is recommended by a qualified treating clinician employed or retained by the prison where he is held in custody. Once again, you can see how ambiguous this is. because it doesn't actually guarantee Assange any medical care. It only says he'll get medical care if the prison physician agrees to it. Jeffrey Sterling was suffering a heart condition while in prison. When he asked the prison doctors for medical attention because of chest pains and shortness of breath, his calls for help fell on deaf ears. It took scores of people, including a U.S. senator, pleading on his behalf before he was finally given any medical attention.
When I was in prison, I developed heart issues. I had had previous issues with my heart. One day I felt like I was having a heart attack. I remember going to the medical staff, and they were completely blowing me off. I mean, their answer to me having chest pains and shortness of breath and breaking out in a sweat was to drink more water. I let my wife know what was going on, because where else was I to turn? And she rallied thousands of people to bombard the prison with emails, phone calls. And eventually, a U.S. senator reached out to the prison and asked what was going on with regard to my health and whether I was receiving health care or not. Only through that effort, that incredible effort, was I able to get the health care that I needed. Had I not, and in prison, there were many times where you could see, and you know, I've seen individuals who were dead, inmates who died because they did not receive proper medical attention. I was certainly fearful that I was going to be another of that number. And it took that incredible effort, spearheaded by my wife and my supporters throughout the world, for me to get just basic medical attention. And that is so typical of the U.S. prison system. The best way to describe U.S. prisons are they're just human warehouses, places to put bodies, categorize them, file them away, and forget about them. And any interaction is, again, perpetual punishment. So they will go out of their way, the staff, they'll go out of the way to abuse, neglect your needs, and really make life miserable. It's miserable enough being in prison, but they go out of their way to emphasize all of that to any inmate.
Speaking of medical assistance in prison, in the U.S. prison system, you know, I've been covering Julian Assange's case, and one of the assurances the United States government has given him is that once in U.S. custody, he'll receive medical attention under the recommendation of the prison physician, whatever that means. And there's one tweet that you wrote that says, quote, "I can guarantee that in a U.S. prison, he, meaning Assange, would not receive medical attention. It took the attention of a U.S. senator for me to receive proper medical attention," as you just recalled. Could you expand on that for us, you know, given your own experience, what you've seen there, what it would be like for Julian Assange, what it is like for others who are in the U.S. prison system?
Again, healthcare is an afterthought in U.S. prisons. They will go out of their way to make sure they're not providing any care for you, for anyone. Any medical issues, the first position that is taken is that the individual, and also in my case, that the individual is faking, that just want attention or the opportunity to get outside the walls, to go to a doctor. So there's the first step is to blame the inmate for the condition. The next step is to do nothing. And then the third, when people started reaching out early on, in my case, the most effort that they will put in is defending their position and calling everyone else a liar. Or again, relying on, well, this it's not as serious as the person is taking it. All the while shielding themselves behind those walls, the prison walls, to not provide the care that they are supposed to provide. And I think that is across the board. That was in a U.S. prison. When I was first arrested, I was at the Alexandria Detention Center. I received no medical care there either. I had just come off a month of, I was still rehabilitating from knee replacement surgery. It was quite a serious involved surgery. They provided absolutely no medical care for me there. In fact, they were giving me, quote, painkillers that were contraindicated to the blood thinners that I was on. You make complaints about this, and it goes absolutely nowhere. I mean, if there is a home of bureaucracy, it is the Bureau of Prisons or any jail system.
Sterling also told me about the psychological torment that he was subjected to while in prison. He was neglected and threatened by the prison medical staff with solitary confinement if he didn't cut it out with feeling depressed.
Speaking of health, the other aspect is mental health. There will be absolutely no attention or any sort of assistance with mental health. When I was in prison throughout that ordeal that lasted for so many years, I was certainly suicidal at times. I was very down. My feeling was that my country has thrown me out. My country didn't want me. My country didn't believe me. So I was certainly mentally in a very bad state. I was called before the prison psychologist and threatened with being thrown in solitary if I didn't essentially cut it out. If I didn't stop being depressed, I was going to be put in solitary, which would, of course, made the situation even worse. But that is typical of the type of, and I use the term loosely, care that anyone in the prison system will receive. I don't even think there's a question of that. And the so-called assurances that the U.S. authorities have given to the U.K. courts aren't worth the paper that they're written on. It has really shocked me how the case, you know, throughout the entire proceeding has really been based on untruths, if not lies, about what Julian is going to be facing. One is that he would not receive 175 years. And they had the audacity early in the proceedings to highlight my case as a benchmark for the type of sentence anyone going up against the Espionage Act would receive. I was facing over 100 years. When the judge gave me 42 months, the prosecutor was absolutely livid. He was wanting far more than that. And that is exactly what Assange is going to face. Any assurances about not receiving a harsh sentence are incredible that they would even make such a claim.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time. Just really appreciate you coming on, sharing your experiences with us and your invaluable insight and knowledge. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I recently published classified documents of the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Spanish courts about the extradition of David Mendoza Herarte. He was also given similar assurances to those of Assange. In fact, he even signed a contract, as we just mentioned before. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case during the High Court hearings in October. In the High Court judgment, the judges say they examined Mendoza's and Abu Hamza's cases and found that, quote, neither provides any evidence of a failure to comply with an assurance, and neither provides any support for Mr. Assange's submission that this court should not regard the offered assurances as reliable. If you look carefully, just before that, they state that, quote, both can be said to show that the USA may be expected to apply the strict letter of an assurance which it has given. They're basically admitting that US assurances are so vague the US can get around them without really breaking them, and that is the whole problem. Now, when I read this, I'm frankly astounded. It sounds to me like the judges only read the verbal note, the diplomatic note, sent by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid in January 2009. But that is just one assurance in Mendoza's case. Now, diplomatic assurances can come in many forms, and Mendoza did receive another. He had a contract called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. This contract, this diplomatic assurance, was signed by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, by the Spanish government, and Mendoza himself. And it clearly stipulates that Mendoza must be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. He cannot be given a life sentence, and so on. Did the High Court judges in England see this contract at all? Because if the initial verbal note was vague, well, this document certainly isn't. The Acta de Entrega is a very crystal clear contract and a diplomatic assurance that the United States violated without a doubt. They blocked Mendoza's transfer to Spain 3 times and kept him in the U.S. for almost 7 years. This is all in the documents that I published. Now, I can tell you that these documents were never shown or cited in any of the Assange court proceedings as of yet, which makes me wonder, did the judges even get a chance to examine them at all? How can they arrive to such a conclusion after looking at Mendoza's case? Because if they're missing all these documents, it's simply impossible to understand what happened. The High Court's decision to allow Assange's extradition to the United States is extremely disturbing on several fronts. Instead of pointing this out, instead of pointing out that this indictment criminalizes national security journalism, the corporate media, the mainstream media, are just joking around and gloating at the prospect of someone going to prison for the rest of their lives. For what? For doing their job as a journalist, which is something the people at MSNBC and CNN and the BBC know nothing about. Now, the High Court accepted that Assange is suicidal, that the extradition would be oppressive, but they also decided to trust the United States. They trust the U.S. to treat him well. And I must say, I'm shocked at this ruling. I don't understand how they could come to such a conclusion, especially after they say they looked at other extraditions like Mendoza's. Now, Assange's legal team have 14 days from the decision to request an appeal at the Supreme Court. Stella Morris, who is Assange's partner and also on the legal team, has confirmed that they will be doing this. When Assange is in court, they're not discussing press freedoms anymore. They've already criminalized that. And right now, they're discussing how he's going to be treated in U.S. custody and whether he'll kill himself because of how bad the prison conditions are. They're discussing whether these diplomatic assurances can be trusted. The answer is no. And that's what people must fight to highlight right now. That's why right now Mendoza's case is more important than ever, because it exposes how the United States and its promises cannot be trusted. I can tell you, the documents that I published were never mentioned as of yet in the courtroom during Assange's extradition proceedings. So whether the High Court judges have actually seen these documents, I don't know. But if they did see these documents, if they did see how the U.S. broke its assurances every single day for almost 7 years when it kept Mendoza in the U.S. and denied his transfer application 3 times, then I simply don't understand how they came to the conclusion that they can trust assurances for Assange, because they are terribly, terribly mistaken, and time is running out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The Limelight.
A new analysis shows that nearly 750 billionaires in the United States saw their combined wealth soar by $1 trillion in 2021, a 25% jump that, if taxed, would be enough to fully fund major priorities in Democrats' stalled Build Back Better package. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Wealth of U.S. Billionaires Rose $1 Trillion in 2021 as Build Back Better Stalls. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis shows that nearly 750 billionaires in the United States saw their combined wealth soar by $1 trillion in 2021, a 25% jump that, if taxed, would be enough to fully fund major priorities in Democrats' stalled Build Back Better package. According to fresh number crunching by Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, Tesla, and SpaceX founder Elon Musk led the billionaire pandemic profiteers with $118.2 in wealth gains last year, a 77% increase from 2020. Musk's single-year wealth gain alone, ATF found, would more than pay for Build Back Better's $109 billion plan to offer 6 years of free preschool for 6 million children. Former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, meanwhile, saw their net worths grow by $1.4 billion and $18.3 billion, respectively. U.S. billionaires now collectively own $5.1 trillion in wealth, ATF's analysis finds. By contrast, according to the latest Federal Reserve data, the bottom 50% of the U.S. population combined owns $3.4 trillion in wealth. While 2021 was a year of frustrated hopes and tighter budgets for most Americans, it was another banner year for the nation's billionaires, ATF Executive Director Frank Clement said in a statement. Crucially, under current law, the billionaires' massive windfall